sports writer David Goldblatt's new book, The Games, A Global History of the Olympics, is a history of the biggest sporting event of them all. He tells the epic story of the Games from their reinvention in Athens in 1896 to the present day, chronicling classic moments of sporting achievement to explore how international conflicts have played out at the Olympics, including the role of the Games in Germany and Italy, the Cold War, and the struggles of the post-colonial world for recognition. He also tells the story of how women fought to be included on equal terms, how the Paralympics started in the wake of World War II, and how the Olympics reflect changing attitudes to race and ethnicity. And as we begin the Summer Games in Rio de Janeiro, we welcome David Goldblatt to the roundtable this morning. Again, the name of the book is The Games, A Global History of the Olympics. David, welcome to the program. Thank you very much for being with us.
Lovely to be here. Thank you.
What brought you to want to look at this global history of the Olympics?
Well, I've got a bit of form for this. So I wrote a book called The Ball is Round, A Global History of Soccer, which traced the history of the game over the last 150 years. And as I suspected before I wrote that, it would enable me to write, in effect, shadow history, technologically, economically, politically, of the modern world. But, you know, soccer is obviously not everything, and the Olympics has its own very particular trajectory and its particular rivalries, and it captures aspects of world history that are not necessarily caught by football. I mean, particularly the presence, you know, of women athletes, the importance of the Cold War, given football's relatively limited importance in the US. So, if you like, I got a second bite at the cherry to tell the story of the modern world through the lens of a sport, and in this case, a very particular mega event.
And in the creation of that mega event, how has it evolved, and where would you put the importance now as we enter these 2017 games?
Well, I think to start with your second question, I think the Olympics, although the Football World Cup has been catching up in various ways, is the single biggest public cultural event. I mean, really, sort of in world history. I mean, pretty much half the world, you know, is watching at least some of it. The degree of singular focus on one place, on one thing by so many people on so many screens through so many media is unparalleled. And it's sort of, you know, worth remembering that's part of the reason there's so much money, so much status, and so much prestige involved, is that the Olympics, rather bizarrely, offers, you know, the elites of world cities and states the opportunity to send a message of great complexity and sophistication in a way that they would never otherwise be able to. So it remains incredibly significant. As to your first question, how did we get here? I mean, the Olympics has been through, I would say, three or four sort of mutations in its, you know, 120-year history. It begins effectively as a neo-Hellenic cult of the gentleman amateur of Northern Europe and the United States, an exclusively male, upper-class, white affair. It transmutes, you know, into a kind of, you know, much more global spectacle once the Olympics makes its peace with nation states and with, you know, political power, of which Berlin 1936 is the perhaps the earliest, the most obvious example. And then it makes its peace with commerce in the 1990s when amateurism is abandoned and sponsors, television and professional athletes arrive. And in the last, I would say, in the last 20 years, buoyed by that, it has become, you know, this extraordinary instrument of global soft power. I mean, the Chinese Politburo does not spend £150 million on the opening ceremony of anything without wanting to send a very serious political message. So that's sort of where we've got to, and that seems to me part of the kind of the problem and the pathology is that these grotesquely inflated Olympics, you know, are what we're sort of left with at the end of 120 years of sport. And so much of the original or alternative arguments for staging the thing have drained away.
It is interesting to see, and even in the past few years, cities that work so hard to bring the Olympics to their region, there are cities who are working just as hard to make sure that they don't. And I use Boston as an example.
Absolutely.
And it shows what it can do. We saw this, of course, in London. We've seen it in other places as well, where that sighting has caused many more problems than it solved.
Sure. I mean, you know, we have a real growth of anti-Olympic movements, particularly at the stage of, you know, bidding for the Games. And the 2022 Winter Olympics, which will be held in Beijing, was done from a choice of just two. We were down to Almaty in Kazakhstan and Beijing, which is 180 miles from the nearest mountains. And, you know, Oslo had pulled out, Stockholm pulled out, St. Moritz pulled out, all because of pressure from below, you know, on politicians. And this is a real problem for the Olympic movement. And, you know, this is why Thomas Bach, the president, amongst the many headaches he has tried to reform the process of bidding for the Games to make it cheaper, easier, less kind of cookie cutter and franchisee sort of model, and more of a dialogue with our host cities. But, you know, for 2024, we have four bids, but Budapest is not a serious bid. Rome is about to be withdrawn because of the new radical mayor's opposition. And then we're down to LA and Paris. And, you know, there are very few cities in this world, like Los Angeles, that can just go UCLA and USC student dorms of the Olympic Village, done. So I think we're in real, you know, we're in very dangerous territory for the Olympics. And I don't think Rio is going to encourage anybody to be bidding anytime soon.
We will talk a little bit about Rio in a moment, but I do want to stay on this line of how we got to this particular point and go back to the phases that you talked about. Is there a purity both in the selection process and the amateur aspect of the Games, which is what started this? Is that purity gone away that has made it so fraught?
There never was a great deal of, you know, purity in the selection process. I mean, just as one example, 1904 was originally intended for Chicago, which was pretty much the instructions of Baron de Coubertin, because the right kind of gentleman ran the University of Chicago and its athletics club. But, of course, the planned World's Fair, the Louisiana Centenary Purchase Exhibition, which had been planned for 1903, was running late, and it was held in 1904. And the organizers of the World's Fair had no intention of allowing some athletic sideshow in Chicago to divert attention from what they were doing. And so they exerted enormous financial and political pressure on everybody in Chicago, the American Athletics Union, and basically wrested the Games away from Chicago and took them to the World's Fair. So, you know, if we go all the way back, there have always been political issues involved in the allocation of the Games. As for amateurism, you know, the idea that amateurism is primarily a form of, you know, purification or a way of, you know, preventing unpleasant commerce, sullying sport in some way. It was actually, you know, a form of class exclusion. Because, of course, you know, amateurs, you know, the amateur that the Olympics is thinking of in the 19th century is a gentleman amateur who can afford and has leisure time to engage in sport and go to the Olympics. And what we actually find is that, you know, what amateurism really means, let's take the example of the Henley Regatta, the premier rowing event and club in Britain in the 19th century, and one beloved by Baron de Coubertin, who modeled the IOC's governance on it. You know, they were saying not only can you not compete if you have ever taken money as a rower or won prize money, but if you've ever taken money as a manual labourer, you are not permitted to row at Henley. And that's what the Game is. You know, I mean, 50 years later, Avery Brundage, as the president of the IOC, evokes, you know, a completely mythic past and a mythic meaning to what amateurism was really about. And if I can just add, I mean, the notion that there was amateurism in the ancient Games is completely preposterous. You know, there may not have been cash prizes at Olympia, but, you know, there was a whole network of athletics and performance across the ancient Greek world, in which, you know, payment and prizes were the norm. And that certainly didn't prevent you from coming to the ancient games. And everybody knew that if you did win your laurels at Olympia, you would go home and it would be no problem to parlay that into land, slaves, money, status, or political office. And no one, you know, thought that was problematic anyway. So, you know, the appeal to the ancient world, you know, is based on a misreading of the sources, and the concept of amateurism that originally sustained the games, you know, with its kind of frankly white male upper class exclusivity, I would say is morally pretty unpalatable these days.
So looking at Rio and where we are now on the start of these 2016 games, is this the culmination of what we've been seeing over the past 100-plus years, and where do you go from that? And a separate question, if I may, which is it possible to differentiate between the politics of it and the concerns, the many concerns having to do with the venue and the actual sporting competitions that will be going on over the next 3 weeks?
Joe, you ask big questions. So I'll try number one first. I mean, I would say Rio in a way is a sort of the culmination of the last, in its particular sort of disastrous and chaotic form, is a sort of culmination of trends over the last 20 or 30 years when the Olympics has become so gigantic and so expensive, and it has elements of many of the games of the last 20 years. I mean, it's almost as late as Athens, though nothing is, I think, to be really quite as late as Athens. But Rio's giving it a good go with a metro line opening 4 days before the beginning of the games. I mean, I think in terms of corruption and rake-offs in the building of the stadiums, I mean, obviously this has been going on for a long time. Sochi was worse. But again, as we know from the huge corruption scandal unfolding in Brazil, the Olympics has been a site of widespread money laundering and embezzlement. I think in terms of, you know, overall mad cost, obviously it's not quite as huge as some of the others, but it's certainly a brilliant example of the kind of failed legacies of the games. I mean, one of the kind of central purposes, you know, of the bid book was to reform Rio's sewage system, which it is desperately in need, and to provide transport for the poorest people in the north of the city, you know, who are doing 2.5-3 hours a day on a bus. And what we've actually got is absolutely no reform and rebuilding of the sewage system, which everyone will continue to have to live with, dead bodies floating in the sailing lake, and a transport system which is basically designed to move rich people from one place to another while neglecting the rest of it. So again, you know, you can find examples of this in other games, but Rio has brought them all together and added the twist of being conducted at a time of cataclysmic economic recession, massive political constitutional crisis, and, well, let's just throw the Zika virus in as well. And of course, unlike Sochi or Beijing, you know, Brazil, for all its faults, is an open society, and it's letting it all hang out. So to, you know, with that thought, to answer your second question, you know, what is the kind of, where do we go from here and how can we watch the games? I mean, you know, the bill's been paid, right? The money's been paid, and I'm not sure I'm at the point of saying we should be conducting a consumer boycott, that I do wonder whether I might get to that with the 2022 World Cup in Qatar. But I think, you know, people have been working all their lives to put on extraordinary athletic performances at these games, and respect is due. And so I'm going to take, you know, a big bag of history, a very healthy dose of skepticism and cynicism, and as much of my sense of humor as I can muster. And I'm going to watch, you know, and see what happens as the games unfold.
My final question to you has to do with doping, and you address this in the book and look at the history of doping in the Olympics, and the impact on these scandals, which of course filter out to the sporting world at large.
Yeah, I mean, it's a pretty extraordinary moment, you know, the state-sponsored doping program in Russia being unveiled by WADA Special Investigation, and the IOC, I mean, this is an issue not just of doping, though of course that's unbelievably important, but of the state of governance of global sport. You know, and the IOC has passed the buck, despite this sort of rank contravention of the Olympic Charter, to the international sports federations. And, you know, Russians will be showing up. And I think one needs to draw a line in the sand here, because Russia's behavior has not only, you know, imperiled other athletes and cheated other athletes, but has poisoned the institutions of international sport, where there has been, we know in athletics, and I have no doubt elsewhere, active collusion of people with what's going on in Russia. So I think it's been a terrible missed opportunity to cleave to two of the things that the Olympics still is meant to stand for, which is clean sport, with integrity, and transparent, you know, democratic governance of global sport. So I think it's fabulously disappointing what's happened.
The name of the book is The Games, A Global History of the Olympics. It is published by Norton. David Goldblatt, a great pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you very much for spending time with us.
Thank you for having me.
Again, the name of the book is The Games, A Global History of the Olympics. The book is published by Norton. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.